The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
They might know about some operations that the U.S. conducts in Yemen, but don't know that we have an actual proxy force under this program operating there. And, one of the places that we were, it was one of the first ones that I found out about, one of the most difficult to pin down was a program in Egypt called Enigma Hunter, where U.S. Special Operations Forces partnered with the Egyptian military for operations in the Sinai Peninsula. And, this is an area where, the Sinai is subject to a near total media blackout. Human rights groups have documented widespread abuses, including torture, extrajudicial killings, attacks on civilians. And are the 127 Echo proxy forces involved in these abuses? We don't know because the oversight is really lax, and the reporting on it, by the U.S. government is almost nil.
I'm Tyler McBrien, managing editor of Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare podcast, August 9th, 2022. Last month, The Intercept published a new investigation from Aliche Spiri and Nick Terse, looking into a secretive funding authority at the Pentagon known as 127E, or 127 Echo. Using exclusive documents and interviews, the reporters revealed how U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known. To discuss the program and what it means for U.S. foreign policy, I sat down with Nick, an investigative journalist at The Intercept, who has reported on 127 Echo for years. We discussed the history of the funding authority, what these new documents and interviews can tell us about U.S. proxy wars, and how much we still don't know. It's the Lawfare Podcast, August 9th. Nick Terse on the Pentagon's secretive funding authority, 127E.
Nick, I wanted to start first definitionally to kind of set the scene with maybe a deceptively complex question. And that is, what is the 127E authority?
Okay, so basically 127 Echo is a rather obscure funding authority that allows the United States to utilize foreign forces as surrogates, outright proxies. It's unlike traditional BPC or building partner capacity programs or security assistance programs, because while the U.S. Arms, trains, and provides intelligence to these foreign forces, it isn't about building their capacity, building them up, or accomplishing the goals of their own governments. Instead, 127E partners are dispatched on U.S.-directed missions targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims. And this program is run by America's most elite troops, Army Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and other special operations forces. And depending on the locale, they may accompany their proxies into the field on missions. So these foreign partners, these U.S. proxies who are working with our special operations forces, are fighting and killing on America's behalf.
Great. And just kind of a brief survey of your reporting, seems like you've been on the 127 Echo beat for a while. What first interested you in this, as you said, obscure, little-known Pentagon program?
Yeah, I've been reporting on 127 Echo programs since 2017 or 2018. And basically, I started by looking at how they were used in Africa. I've been covering the U.S. military in Africa for more than 10 years now, closer to 15. And, as I dug more into U.S. operations in Africa, U.S. military bases in Africa. I started to hear about this. You know, at the time, I really wasn't even sure what it was. 127 Echo program, I think, is what I first heard. And, you know, I gathered a little more information, a little more. And then I came to understand that this was it was a funding authority that grew out of basically the earliest stages of the war on terror in Afghanistan. And, you know, first I looked at how it was used in Africa. And then, you know, for the last couple of years, I've been working on the reporting of you know, how it's been used outside of Africa, but it took a long time to really dig into that, and it was only with the assistance of my partner in writing this, Alice Sperry, that we were able to put the entire story together and finally publish on it.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into your investigation that was just published in The Intercept, and some of the revelations that came to light with these new documents, but just to dig back into the history a bit of the 127 Echo Authority, you mentioned it has its origins in, you know, the early post 9/11 wars. If you could just kind of talk a bit more about its origin, what motivated the creation of this new authority? You know, what was the military seeking to do that it felt like it couldn't do without the creation of this funding authority?
Sure, that's right. You know, it begins with the earliest days of U.S. war in Afghanistan. As commandos and CIA personnel sought to support the Afghan Northern Alliance in their fight against the Taliban. So we're talking about, you know, days, weeks after 9/11. And at that time, Army Special Operations Command realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new Afghan proxies, and it was forced to rely on CIA funding. And this prompted a broader push by Special Operations Command to secure the ability to support foreign forces on counterterrorism missions. So a corollary to the CIA's long use of militia surrogates in Afghanistan and other places. And, you know, at first was known as Section 1208. And the authority was employed in the early years of after the invasion of Iraq. And yeah, that's something else that Alice and I were able to break in our new reporting. So it came into being as 1208 in Afghanistan and Iraq. And then several years later, this funding authority was enshrined in the U.S. federal code under Title 10, 127E, so 127 Echo.
Could you give us a sense of the scope of these programs? Again, before we, you know, fully get into the new reporting, you mentioned you've been on the trail for quite some years now. What's the scope of these operations? You know, where are the theaters of operation? You know, how many missions have you found that this was attached to?
You know, this has fluctuated over the years about, you know, how many of these 127 Echo programs have been run. And, you know, some have come into being and then, you know, they've run their course and, you know, they've disappeared. But, you know, we were able to confirm that at least 14 127 Echo programs were active in the greater Middle East and the Asia-Pacific region as recently as 2020. And we determined that between 2017 and 2020, U.S. commandos conducted at least 23 separate 127 Echo programs across the world. And we were able to put this together through some documents that we've received through records requests and interviews with almost two dozen current and former U.S. government officials.
Yeah, I'm really interested in your reporting process. So without, you know, giving away too many of your trade secrets, how was this process of FOIAing documents related to 127 Echo, you know, similar or different from some of your past reporting? And similarly with the interviews, I was struck with how forthcoming particularly General Vodal was in speaking about it on the record. I guess if you could speak to the secrecy of the program and how you were able to bring some of these revelations to light.
Yeah, this is a highly classified program. And, you know, for more than a year, I asked the White House to provide some comment on this. And, you know, they referred me to the Department of Defense. I went to the Office of the Secretary of Defense. They've been threatening to respond to my questions for several months and never have. And Special Operations Command itself was at least forthcoming in saying that they wouldn't say anything. They at least came out and said that these are classified programs. We won't comment on them in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, there was no, you know, clear way in through press offices. And, you know, with Freedom of Information Act requests, they take a long time. And I had to put in a lot of different requests. And the documents that I got back were highly redacted. And it was a matter of, you know, fitting together the small amount of information that we could glean from a lot of different documents. And then Alicia and I taking them to our sources. And to write this specific article, I think I started reporting of it about 2 years ago. And, you know, Alicia and I spent together about 6 months on it. So it was a long reporting process to get this. And, you know, like you, I was really struck by General Votel's, you know, frank discussion of this program. It's not common when dealing with 127 Echo or similarly classified programs. He's a retired four-star Army general. He headed both Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in the Middle East. So he had a front row seat and oversaw these programs, you know, in a way that very few commanders have. So I was, you know, it was exceptionally helpful to have, you know, his assistance in this.
Yeah, I'd like to amend my previous question. Perhaps forthcoming was a bit too generous or strong of a word, but you know, in keeping with this theme of speaking with General Votel, I think it gave a really interesting window into some of the arguments in favor of programs like this. Could you speak to you know, some of these arguments that you heard from either the general or other government officials who advocate for these programs and, you know, who speak to the upshot of them?
Yeah, General Votel also, I don't think he's actually named in this article, but in some previous reporting on this, retired Brigadier General Don Baldock, who headed Special Operations Command Africa, has also been fairly forthcoming on this. And both they and people that we spoke to on background and off the record, commanders associated with this program, really tout it. You know, they see it as exceptionally successful. One, it keeps U.S. boots on the ground to a minimum, so it reduces the risk for U.S. forces. This risk is outsourced to partner forces, but, you know, this has been a real selling point of the program. Another thing is access, and this also comes through even in the documents that are highly redacted. You can see that again and again, programs are touted as providing U.S. special operators with access to areas that would otherwise be denied. And we're talking about even the most elite U.S. forces couldn't get to these places if they weren't working with foreign surrogates. So, you know, they're able to operate in forward denied areas that that otherwise U.S. personnel just couldn't operate in on any kind of, you know, long running basis. So these are two of the most important selling points when you talk to commanders and people who are see the program in a very positive light. The current commander of Special Operations Command, a four-star general named General Richard Clark, he's also touted this program for years before Congress, and he's said that it directly resulted in the capture or killing of thousands of terrorists. So, you know, successful in that way as well. Clark's claims, however, they can't be verified in any way, or we weren't able to. You know, I went to SOCOM and asked, you know, what the actual figures were that General Clark was quoting. And the spokesperson at Special Operations Command told me that they don't actually have figures on those captured, killed during 127 Echo missions. So, you know, where did Clark get those numbers? You know, your guess is as good as mine.
So can we talk about the flip side now then? I think implicit in some of the benefits are actually some drawbacks and some criticisms, especially in thinking about U.S. forces in places where they maybe quote unquote shouldn't be or couldn't access otherwise. So what did some of the critics of the program tell you?
I mean, there's no shortage of criticisms of this program in terms of accountability and oversight. You know, critics of 127 Echo warn that, you know, in addition to the risk of unanticipated military escalation and the potential cost of engaging in these myriad conflicts around the world, some operations may amount to an unlawful use of force. And they also point to the problems associated with working with these surrogates around the world. The 127 Echo Authority is unique because the programs are exempt from a safeguard that's required of other security assistance programs. It's known as the Leahy Law, which is basically the scrutiny of recipients' human rights records. It's named after Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont. It's been, you know, a fixture of U.S. security assistance for many years now. But there's a loophole that exempts 127 Echo. Again, proponents of the program say that it allows the military to set these programs up fast and employ them without these encumbrances. But there's a lot of members of Congress and those in the human rights community who say this is it's a major problem. And there's been a legislative effort to close that loophole by requiring 127 Echo partners to undergo human rights vetting. Last year, it was in the House version of the annual defense bill, but it was cut during negotiations with the Senate. And just this past week, Senator Chris Von Holland of Maryland and Representative Sarah Jacobs of California introduced legislation to again close the 127E vetting loophole that would allow for shutting off funds to units that were found to be committing atrocities. And also, they're asking for an expansion of 127 Echo reporting requirements. You know, this is something else that, you know, critics of the program say that there just isn't enough reporting by Special Operations Command, by the Defense Department, on what these surrogates are out there doing.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Could your political views make you the target of cybercrime, identity theft, stalking, or even violence? I used to think this was silly, and then weird things started happening to me. Someone defaced my car. It had Lawfare license plates on it. Somebody delivered weird antique postcards of Guantanamo Bay to my house. You know, weird stuff. The volume of personal data online has tripled between 2019 and 2023. And angry individuals fueled by political polarization can access it all for up to 98% of American citizens. And I was one of them. Lots of people were using my name, my home address, other information about me to try to intimidate me. And I want to say that has dramatically slowed down in recent months. And one of the reasons is Delete Me. As I have said before, there are products here that I read the ads because, you know, that's my job. And there are products here that I read the ads because I really use them and really like them. And Delete Me is one of the Lawfare advertisers that I am most enthusiastic about. And here's why. It finds and removes personal information I don't want online, and it makes sure it stays off. It's a subscription service that removes your personal information from all of the largest search databases on the web. And in the process, it helps prevent
potential identity theft, doxing, and phishing scams. And here's the important point. It doesn't just do it once, because the information will get back into the systems. It does it, and then it does it again. So the first time I got one of these reports, and they send regular reports at Delete Me, you know, there were a whole bunch of systems that I'd come off of. But then each time I get one now, there's still one or two or three that I'm back on the system and Delete Me has once again deleted me. So sign up and provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts will take it from there. And as I say, they send regular personalized privacy reports showing what info they have found, where they found it, and what they removed. It's always working for you, constantly monitoring and removing the personal information you don't want on the internet. When you sign up, they immediately go to work scrubbing all your personal information from data broker platforms. Your personal profile is no longer theirs to sell. So take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me, now at a special discount for Lawfare listeners. Today, get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and use the promo code Lawfare20 at checkout. The only way to get 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/lawfare20 and enter code Lawfare20 at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/lawfare20, code Lawfare20.
Yeah, you began to talk about some of the things that distinguish 127 Echo programs from other, you know, equip and train programs, such as, you know, the ones that you mentioned that the CIA is engaged in or other units of the military. To get into some more of the mechanics of exactly what this looks like, were you able to obtain any information of specific 127E operations in specific places and what it looked like, essentially? You know, how many commandos were involved? Were U.S. troops actually engaged in combat, or were they, you know, behind the scenes? And where some of these things happened?
Now, it depends on the locale. You know, when there have been several 127 Echo programs run in Somalia, for example, and there it's Navy SEALs that are working with their local Somali counterparts or surrogates from neighboring countries that are conducting operations with U.S. personnel in Somalia. They're very small teams of U.S. forces, but in Somalia and in most places in Africa, these U.S. forces go out into the field with their foreign partners. One of the revelations that we had in our recent reporting, Alicia and I, was revealing the existence of a 127 Echo program known as Obsidian Tower that was run in Tunisia. And there was a small team of Marine raiders, and they went out with their local counterparts who were top tier, tier one Tunisian commandos. And, you know, we found that it was one of these 127 Echo missions back in 2017 that ended up in it's been reported as a firefight that U.S. troops were involved in. You know, this is it's supposed to be foreign surrogates who are involved in combat on our behalf, but when U.S. troops go out with them, even though they're supposed to stay within the last area of cover and concealment, you know, on the battlefield, this isn't always possible or practical, and it ends up that U.S. troops on 127 Echo missions can be involved in full-on combat, unbeknownst to the American people, and unbeknownst generally to most people at the State Department or even members of Congress.
Were you able to confirm whether or not U.S. troops were killed in action in any of these operations?
You know, we were told that U.S. troops were injured in 127 Echo operations. We know for certain that this happened during the combat in Tunisia in 2017. It's very likely that it happened in Somalia that same year. A Navy SEAL named Kyle Milliken was killed on a advise assist company operation. It's very likely that was a 127 Echo operation, but we haven't been able to pin that down. And AFRICOM, Special Operations Command, the Pentagon have never come out and said so. But all signs point to it being a death related to the 127 Echo program.
Now, this wouldn't be the Lawfare podcast without getting to some of the finer legal details of the program and kind of the legal justifications behind this use of force abroad. Could you talk about sort of the legal structure behind 127 Echo? Are they, for example, covered under the 2001 AUMF, or are there other legal structures at play here?
Yeah. Now, see, we're getting into one of these murky areas. Now, 127 Echo is a funding authority. So all it really is you know, pots of money that are available. And the authority for conducting these missions is separate. Now, you know, theoretically, these missions, because they're generally targeting Al-Qaeda or ISIS or their affiliates, you know, the U.S. government takes a very liberal view of the AUMF and, you know, most likely has lumped them in under that rubric. Now, there are a lot of critics who will tell you that, you know, these affiliates or Al-Shabaab in Somalia had nothing to do, obviously, with 9/11, shouldn't be covered by the AUMF. But, you know, even accepting that, if you look at some place like Tunisia, you know, there have been 22, 23 countries that have been mentioned over the years by the White House in connection with the authorization for the use of military force 2001. And Tunisia is not one of them. They've never made the list. But, you know, as I said, under 127 Echo, there was combat by U.S. forces in Tunisia under this program. So, you know, how you can square that circle, it's impossible to know. And, you know, the White House, the U.S. military, they won't talk about it. But this is something that, you know, for this article, you know, we spoke with Catherine Ebright, who's a leading expert on 127 Echo. She's working on a report on it right now for the Brennan Center for Justice, where she is on staff as counsel. And she told us that there's good reason to suspect that the Pentagon has used 127 Echo partners to engage in combat, you know, beyond the scope of any authorization for the use of military force or permissible self-defense. So basically, she said that this amounts to an unauthorized use of force, or another way of saying it is that it may violate the Constitution.
Your point about that this is a funding authority is well taken. I think the reporting is a great example of you know, show me a budget and I'll show you society's values or what have you. And we've touched on transparency and oversight quite a lot. I'm curious what we still don't know. And if you care to disaggregate the we there, one thing I was struck by in your reporting was the fact that many State Department officials or even members of Congress have access to some of this information, but they don't know what they don't know in a way. So I guess it's a two-part question, kind of who knows what and what does the public still not know about this?
Yeah, the Pentagon really guards this information on 127 Echo. They hold this very close. And, you know, written into the law, written into the funding authority, they have to brief the chief of mission. So basically the ambassador of the country where the 127 Echo program is active. But, you know, we were told, you know, by experts we spoke with and government officials during our reporting that this is where it generally ends for the State Department, that the chief of mission finds out, but the information stays in country and never gets back to the home base in Washington, D.C. So State Department personnel that really, you know, would have a good grasp of the legal ins and outs of 127 Echo and, you know, possible issues with accountability, with oversight, with, you know, the partners that the U.S. Is working with, they never find out about this. Same thing with Congress. Members of the Armed Services Committee have access to information on 127 Echo, but generally their staff doesn't. And most members of Congress don't have the time to devote to going and reading up on this. And members of the Foreign Affairs Committee, who should know about the affairs of U.S. abroad, you know, what the United States is doing, don't have access to this material. you know, they should be the ones who have eyes on, you know, where the U.S. is, you know, for want of a better word, at war, and they don't have access to this information. So I think this is, you know, this is another aspect of real accountability and oversight problems. Yeah, if members of Congress don't know about this, you know, obviously most of the American public has no idea. They don't know that you know, that we're running a program in Lebanon that's targeting ISIS. They might know about some operations that the U.S. conducts in Yemen, but don't know that we have an actual proxy force under this program operating there. And you know, one of the places that we were, you know, it was one of the first ones that I found out about. One of the most difficult to pin down was a program in Egypt called Enigma Hunter, where U.S. Special Operations Forces partnered with the Egyptian military for operations in the Sinai Peninsula. And, you know, this is an area where, you know, the Sinai is subject to a near total media blackout. Human rights groups have documented widespread abuses, including torture, extrajudicial killings, attacks on civilians. And are the 127 Echo proxy forces involved in these abuses? You know, we don't know, because the oversight is really lax, and the reporting on it, you know, by the U.S. government is almost nil. So, you know, these are the types of things that we don't know, but that some members of Congress think that we should. And, you know, it's something that Alicia and I continue to try and dig into.
I'm sure the irony was not lost on you that the program that you had most difficulty figuring out was called Enigma Hunter.
Exactly. Yeah.
And finally, I kind of wanted to zoom out a bit from this program. You know, as someone who's had extensive experience reporting on U.S. foreign policy and national security, how has the 127 Echo authority been indicative of kind of our post 9/11 or the U.S.'s post 9/11 wars? Is it, you know, indicative of a broader trend? And what can it tell us about, for example, the Biden administration's commitment to ending what many people call the endless wars?
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by the fact that, you know, right before President Biden's recent trip to the Middle East, he said, you know, he was going to be the first president in two decades to travel to a Middle East where, you know, U.S. forces weren't engaged in combat. There were drone strikes, you know, leading right up to it. So, you know, that seemed to put the lie to it. But I was struck by the fact there are, you know, numerous 127 Echo programs, which are, you know, you can't differentiate from combat that are going on there. So I think in that way, you know, it's very much of these post 9/11 wars, the forever wars. These programs are going on, you know, basically in secret, unknown to the American people, you know, small brushfire wars in countries around the world. And it is indicative of a trend. There are some other programs that Alicia and I mentioned in our Intercept article that are very similar to 127 Echo in the way that they operate, and also in the way that they skirt effective oversight. We mentioned one called Section 1202, which came into being in 2018. And this provides support to foreign irregular forces that are engaged in irregular warfare. It's even a little scarier than 127 Echo because it's focused on so-called near peer competitors. So we're talking about China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, and you know, it's scarier having U.S. forces involved in, you know, it's scary enough having them involved in combat unbeknownst to the American people in a place like Lebanon or Somalia. But, you know, possibly ending up in a shooting war with China or Russia raises, you know, a lot more concerns. And, you know, we also found another authority buried in the U.S. code called 127 Foxtrot, 127F. This is another black box program that seems very similar to 127 Echo, and we're trying to dig into that. So, you know, there are a number of these authorities that have popped up over the years, and the U.S. military seems very interested in using them. And it is a way to, you know, conduct operations that are as close to off the books as you can get for the military.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for your reporting, and thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Look out for our other podcasts, including Rational Security, Chatter, and our latest Lawfare Presents podcast series on the government's response to January 6th, The Aftermath. Check out our written work at lawfareblog.com. And while you're at it, buy some Lawfare swag at thelawfarestore.com. This podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.